Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our choral service and service of chorals and readings. Welcome to the people in church. Welcome to those joining us via the web camera. And a particular welcome to those members of the congregation maybe who are joining us because they're frail or unwell, unable to attend. It's lovely to have you this morning. And to anyone who happens to listen in to our recordings at a later stage. My name is Bridget Spain, Minister Emerita of this congregation, and it's my privilege to be here this morning to lead my favourite service of all the year. So, the choir has rehearsed, the singers are ready, the leaflets are ready, you know where you are, so we're just going to begin with our opening words, and when I finished, the readers then come forward and we take it from there. Our opening words this morning. We have an old story to tell, one that has been shared over and over for thousands of years, but somehow still remains unheard, and it still remains radical and risky. Christmas arrives not only to comfort, but to awaken us, to reassure us, and also to stir us to new life, a life of peace, justice, and love. It asks us to make room in our world for the refugee, the poor, the pain, and the messy sweetness of a newborn child. If we take the journey to Bethlehem, we will be changed by the presence of a love that meets us there as we are right now, and calls us to journey to a braver and bolder life. To believe that it's not too late for gentle people to win, for compassion and truth to have the final say, for the bright light of hope to shine through, even on the darkest nights. Come, let us celebrate the good news of Christmas. And let us sing and worship together. Our words for the chalice lighting. As we journey to the darkest day of the year, we remember the promise of life abundant and that peace is possible. We pause at this time of mystery to tell the old stories, to sing the familiar songs, to bring light and hope to the world. And to tell the old story, we have Dennis.
You will note from this reading, from the first few lines, that nothing much has changed in the last 2,000 years. St. Luke chapter 2, verse 1. In those days, a decree went out from Emperor Augustus that all the world should be taxed. This was the first taxation and was taken while Quirinius was governor of Syria. All went down to their own towns to be registered. Joseph also from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to the city of David called Bethlehem, because he was descended from the house and family of David. He went to be registered with Mary, to whom he was engaged and was expecting a child. And while they were there, the time came for her to deliver her child. And she gave birth to her firstborn son and wrapped him in bands of cloth and laid him in a manger, because there was no place for them in the inn. In that region, there were shepherds living in the fields, keeping watch over their flocks by night. Then an angel of the Lord stood before them, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them, and they were terrified. But the angel said to them, "Do not be afraid. For see, I'm bringing you good news of great joy for all the people. To you is born this day in the city of David a Saviour, who is the Messiah, the Lord. This will be a sign for you. You will find a child wrapped in bands of cloth and lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host, praising God and saying, "Glory to God in the highest heaven, and on earth peace among those whom he favors." When the angels had left them and gone into heaven, the shepherds said one to another, "Let us go now to Bethlehem and see this thing that has taken place, which the Lord hath made known to us." So they went with haste and found Mary and Joseph and the child lying in a manger. When they saw this, they made known what had been told them about this child. And all who heard it were amazed at what the shepherds told them. But Mary treasured all these words and pondered them in her heart. The shepherds returned, glorifying and praising God for all they had heard and seen as it had been told them.
Five minutes walk from here is this impressive building. Now you can see there's a craft fair on it, but the craft fair is gone, so I'm not promoting anything. It just gives you a sense of the place. Built between 1912 and 1915 by the Guinness family, the Ivy Trust Play Centre, which later became known as the Beano, which is Dublinese for a bean feast, was built to help alleviate poverty in this area and to give children the possibility of education and fun. It remained open until 1975, when it was taken over by the CDVEC, and it is now the Liberties College of Further Education, where I have been blessed to work for the past 30 years. Only last week, a student told me how grateful she is to have found the college, as she believes it to be a special place, and I believe that it is just that because it was built for the good. Within 2 years of opening, 4,000 children were recorded as having attended the facility, which was open for children aged 4 to 14 every evening after school. Great camaraderie developed between kids as they could play football in a large playground, which is now a car park, for the staff only, by the way, learn to dressmake, sing, dance, and enjoy other activities like cookery classes and woodwork. My dad and his siblings attended. In her book, Around the Banks of Pimlico, local historian Maureen Johnson writes about her time at the Beano. Now, as an aside, I interviewed Maureen for a radio documentary on the Ivy Washhouse, which is also situated behind the Ivy Market and Guinness and built by the Guinness family, and I was absolutely chuffed to discover she was one of the women who went on the contraceptive train in 1971, one of many remarkable women. You will see from the following abridged version that the philanthropic good intentions of the providers of the Beano could often be scuppered by the kids themselves. So this is an abridged version. It was in the 1940s that my pals and I used to go to the Beano. And on the way down, we would always sing the song. Tiptoe to the Beano, where the kids go for their bun and cocoa. Tiptoe to the Beano with me. That's on the local traffic box, by the way, now. It was very important to get down there in time, or else you mightn't get in. But getting there too early wasn't the best plan either, because there was the danger of getting involved in gang warfare, and some of the regulars would scrub or reef you to bits if you looked crooked at them. I think some of them were psychic, because by some unknown means, they always knew when opening time was approaching and would start forming a queue. This was the flashpoint when the queue skipping, pushing, shoving, boxing matches and threats started. Wait till I get you outside the gate, you common Rossie. I lave you sucking your blood. You and what army? Who do you think you're looking at, cockeye? Nothing much when I'm looking at you, Gunnery. This kind of name-calling, hair-pulling, kicks in the shin and insults were all the norm, and we were indulged in by the usual few troublemakers who could never keep their hands on themselves. As soon as the doors opened, it was like a stampede, and God help you if you tripped and fell. After the announcement of our day's activities, the reason why most of us were there in the first place was performed, and this was the distribution of buns and tin mugs of Shell cocoa, the Bean Feast. Some of their children really looked forward to these, and the way they wired into the buns showed just how hungry they were. The buns were studded with sultanas and currants, which I thought looked like dead flies. Some of the kids brought paper bags and collected buns from those like myself who couldn't stand the fruit. Even half-eaten buns were swooped up. Now, every year, the children in the Beano were treated to a Christmas party. Admittance was by ticket only and were reserved for the regular attenders. One year, my school pal, Annie Malloy from the Coombe, got two tickets and invited me along. I had never been to a party in my life, so was quite excited. The World and Garrett Riley were there, and like everyone else, I had my own brown paper bag to collect some of the goodies for my mother. Instead of buns and Shell cocoa, we got lovely bottles of lemonade and skinny bars of Cadbury's chocolate, Jacob's biscuits, balloons, paper hats, streamers, sweets and fizz bags. The goodies were being swiped left, right and centre, and it was all I could do to hold on to my presents and the biscuits, which all got mashed up in the bag. The blinds were pulled down and the Charlie Chaplin film started, and we couldn't stop laughing because as well as the films being funny, they kept coming out upside down or the projector would break down. Small kids were roaring and bawling, fights broke out and no one would sit down. It was actually a relief when it was over, but it was great gas all the same, and I'll never forget that skinny bar of Cadbury's chocolate. It was delicious.
Thank you. The Christmas puddings. It begins in October with a phone call. Are you making the puddings this year, ma'am? I don't know, she says. I'll go to the doctor for an antibiotic and maybe I'll be able to make them then. But we know, my brother, my sister and me, that she will. She always does. We've been eating Maudie Flannery's puddings for 50 years. She's not likely to cut us off now. It's not like any of us would know how to make them, because here's the thing. The recipe is so secret that it cannot be written down. It had to be learned by heart. The only two people in the family, only two people in the family were privy to it. Our mam and her sister Peg. They made the puddings together in a bucket over the kitchen table, muttering incantations with flour, butter, eggs, cherries, sultanas, spice, and whiskey. They poured the brown sludge into bowls and covered them with greaseproof paper, sealed it with a knotted string, lowered them into a saucepan of bubbling water and simmered them on the stove. They stayed up all night, fortified by tea and Carol's cigarettes, checking the saucepans and refilling them with kettles of water. Our mother was in her 30s when she started this business about, who's going to make the puddings when I'm gone? Gone where? We asked, astonished. Mam couldn't drive, she'd have to thumb a lift. Dead and gone, she said. My little sister started to cry. Let me tell you something about our mother. She's all talk. 40 years later, we are still asking for her Christmas pudding, and she is still making it. Every year when the weather turns, we apply some gentle pressure. Can you believe there is Christmas stuff in the shops already? Next thing you know, it will be time for you to make the puddings. By Halloween, the pamossing is in full swing. Sure, no one makes them like you. None of us would be any good at it. Christmas would not be the same. She has four pudding bowls. A big one for my brother, he's the eldest. A medium-sized for me, I'm the middle child. And a massive one for my sister, because she has four children and a husband who is nearly 7 foot tall. That leaves a dribble for herself, which she pours into a tiny bowl. Don't mind me, she says. Sure, I'm here on my own. Sure, what would I want with a pudding? The year my son was born, I hit the Christmas pudding jackpot. I was up half the night feeding him, and it made me hungry too. Between feeds, I prowled the kitchen, looking in presses and raided the fridge. The only thing that hit the spot was my mother's Christmas pudding. Peeling back the greaseproof paper in November felt transgressive. I might as well have been sinking a knife into Christmas itself. It tasted divine, and within 48 hours, the medium pudding was gone. It's amazing what you can get away with when you're having a new baby. I phoned my mother. I told her I was tormented by stitches, mastitis, and hemorrhoids. And the only thing that was sustaining me was her Christmas pudding. The brother's pudding was immediately reassigned and dispatched on the next train. A week later, the sister's pudding arrived at my house. After that, my mother called a halt. And then she set about making the puddings again. That was Christmas 2007. And that feels like a lifetime ago. And for my son, that's exactly what it is. In the meanwhile, my brother has gained 2 children, my sister gained 4, and that extremely tall husband. And we have all felt the pain of loss. None of us knows what lies around the corner, what sorrow or unexpected joy. Our mother's Christmas pudding always brings us joy. It's something she gives to each of us and reminds us that another year has passed. And she is still here.
I Like Santa Claus by G.K. Chesterton. What has happened to me has been the very reverse of what appears to be the experience of most of my friends. Instead of dwindling to a point, Santa Claus has grown larger and larger in my life until he fills almost the whole of it. It happened in this way. As a child, I was faced with a phenomenon requiring explanation. I hung up at the end of my bed an empty stocking, which in the morning had become a full stocking. I had done nothing to produce the things that filled it. I had not worked for them, or made them, or helped to make them. I had not even been good, far from it. And the explanation was that a certain being whom people call Santa Claus was benevolently disposed toward me. Of course, most people who talk about these things get into a state of some mental confusion by attaching tremendous importance to the name of the entity. We called him Santa Claus, because everybody called him Santa Claus. But the name of a god is a mere human label. His real name may have been Williams. It may have been the Archangel Uriel. What we believed was that a certain benevolent agency did give us those toys for nothing. And as I say, I believe it still. I merely extended the idea. Then I only wondered who put the toys in the stocking. Now I wonder who put the stocking by the bed in the room, and the room in the house on the planet, and the great planet in the void. Once I thanked Santa for a few dolls and crackers. Now I thank him for stars and street faces and wine and the great sea. Once I thought it delightful and astonishing to find a present so big that it only went halfway into the stocking. Now I am delighted and astonished every morning to find a present so big that it takes two stockings to hold it and then leaves a great deal outside. It is the large and preposterous present of myself, as to the origin of which I can offer no suggestion except that Santa Claus gave it to me in a fit of peculiarly fantastic goodwill.
Poem, The Moment of Magic by Victoria Stafford. Now is the moment of magic, when the whole round earth turns again towards the sun. And here's a blessing. The days will be longer and brighter now, even before the winter settles in to chill us. Now is the moment of magic, when people, beaten down and broken, kindle tiny lights of hope and whisper secret music. And here is a blessing. The dark universe is illuminated by the lights, the menorah. Suddenly the world is ablaze with candles signaling hope, and the whole world is glad and loud with winter singing. Now is the moment of magic, when an eastern star beckons us towards an unknown goal. And here is a blessing. We find nothing in the end but an ordinary baby, born at midnight, born into poverty and the baby's cry like bells ringing, makes people wonder as they wander through their lives what human love might really look like, sound like, feel like. Now is the moment of magic. And here's a blessing. We already possess all the gifts we need. We've already received our presence, ears to hear music, eyes to behold lights, hands to build true peace on earth and to hold each other tight in love.
The Christmas pageant. Our church had not had a full-blown Christmas pageant in years. For one thing, we had become fairly rational about the season, content to let the Sunday school observe the event on their own turf in a low-key way. Then too, there was the last time, and we had gone all out. That week of the Christmas pageant coincided with the outbreak of German measles, chickenpox, and the Hong Kong flu. The night of the pageant, there was a sleet storm, a partial power failure that threw some people's clocks off, and one of the sheep hired for the occasion got diarrhea. That was about par for the course, since Joseph and the two wise men vomited during the performance, and some little angels managed to both cry and wet their pants. To top it off, the choir of teenagers walking about in an irresponsible manner with lighted candles created more a feeling of fear of hellfire and the wrath of God than the feeling of peace on earth. I don't think it was really all that bad, and maybe all those things didn't happen in the same year, but a sufficient number of senior ladies in the church had had it up to here with the whole hoo-ha and tended to squelch any suggestion of another pageant. It was as if cholera had once again been among us and nobody wanted to go through it again. But nostalgia is strong, and it addled the brains of those same senior ladies as they considered the pleas of the younger mothers who had not been through the ritual ordeal and would not be dissuaded. It was time their children had their chance. And in short, in short order, people who kept saying, "I ought to know better," were right in there making angel costumes out of old bed sheets, cardboard and chicken feathers. Just the right kind of bathrobes could not be found for the wise men. So some of the daddies went out and brought new ones and backed a pickup truck over them to age them a bit. One of the young mothers was pregnant, and it was made clear to her in loving terms that she was expected to come up with the newborn child by early December. She vowed to try. An angel choir was lashed into singing shape, a real manger with real straw was obtained, and there was a consensus on leaving out live sheep this time. Some enterprising soul managed to borrow two small goats for the evening. The real coup was renting a live donkey for the mother of Mary to ride on. None of us had ever seen a live donkey ridden through a church chancel, and it seemed like such a fine thing to do at the time. But we made one concession to sanity, deciding to have the thing on a Sunday morning in full light of day so that we could see what we were doing. and nobody in the angel choir could get scared of the dark and cry or wet their pants. No candles either, and no full rehearsal. These things are supposed to be a little hokey, however, and nobody was about to go through the whole thing twice. The great day came and everybody arrived at church. Husbands who were not known for regular attendance came, probably for the same reason that they would be attracted to a train wreck. It wasn't all that bad, really, at least not early on. The goats did get loose in the parking lot and put on quite a rodeo for the shepherds, but we hooted out the carols with full voice and the angel choir got through its first big number almost on key and in unison. The Star of Bethlehem was lit over the manger, and it came time for the entrance of Joseph and Mary, with Mary riding on the donkey, carrying what proved to be a Raggedy Andy doll, since the pregnant lady was overdue. It was the donkey that proved our undoing. The donkey made two hesitant steps through the door of the chancel, took a look at the whole scene and seized up, locked his legs, put his whole body in a cement condition, well beyond rigor mortis, and the procession ground to a halt. Now, there are things you might consider doing to a donkey in private to get it to move, but there is a limit to what you can do to a donkey in church on Sunday morning in front of women, children. Jerking on his halter and some wicked kicking on the part of the Virgin Mary had no effect. The president of the Board of Trustees, seated in the front row and dressed in his Sunday best, rose to the rescue. The floor of the chancel was polished cement. And so with another man pulling at the halter, the president of the board crouched at the stern end of the donkey and pushed, slowly sliding the rigid beast across the floor, inch by stately inch. With progress being made, the choir director turned on the tape recorder, which blared forth a mighty chorus from the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, accompanied by the Philadelphia Orchestra. Just as the donkey and his mobilizers reached mid-church, the tape recorder blew a fuse and there was a sudden silence. And in that silence, an exasperated voice from the backside of the donkey, "Move your ass!" followed immediately by a voice from the rear of the church. The donkey pusher's wife, Leon, shut your filthy mouth. And that's when the donkey brayed. If we had held an election for the jackass of that day, there would have been several candidates mentioned, and the vote would have been pretty evenly distributed. We are such fun to watch when we do what we do. And though it had been several years since the church held another Christmas pageant, we have not seen the last one. The memory of the laughter outlives the memory of the hassle. And hope. Hope always makes us believe that this time, this year, we will get it right. And that's the whole deal with Christmas, I guess. It's just real life, only a lot more of it, all at once than usual. And I suppose we'll continue doing it all, get frenzied and confused and frustrated and even mad, and also get excited and hopeful and quietly pleased. We'll laugh and cry and pout and ponder, get a little drunk and excessive, hug and kiss, and make a great mess, spend too much, and somebody will always be there to get sick or wet their pants. As always, we will sing only some verses of most of those off key. We will do it again and again. We are the Christmas pageant, the whole damn thing. And I think it's best to just let it happen, as at least one person I know can attest to getting pushy about it is trouble.
Thank you. This is a piece called Night Divine, and it's based on a contribution by Paul Howard to Sunday Miscellany. This is Paul Howard, who became more famous later as Ross O'Carroll Kelly. Christmas was never the same for me since I began to have doubts about the man with the beard, and by that I mean God. I enjoy Christmas, but I remember how different I felt when I could stand in a church and sing Silent Night and solemnly believe every word. Christmas is the time of year I think of the time I had to write, sorry, Christmas is the time of the year I think of the time I had to write obituary notices for a local newspaper. Every Monday morning, the news editor would hand me a sheet of A4 paper. Stapled to it were death notices from the Evening Herald and the Evening Press. And my job was to find a telephone number for the bereaved family by cross-checking the address from the death notice and the 01 telephone directory. Then I phoned the bereaved family, and I began by saying that I was sorry to intrude on their grief, but I wished to write an obituary on their recently deceased loved one. I said I would appreciate any information they could supply about their work and their hobbies. Sometimes the person on the other end of the phone would simply put down the phone, either suspecting a scam or too riven with grief to talk. But more often than not, they were happy to share details of their loved one's life. Sometimes these conversations went on for hours, far longer than was necessary to fill the two paragraphs of copy that made up each obituary. The most important aspect of the job was timing. As I discovered in the case of one widow who said, "Can I ring you back another day? I'm just on the way out to the funeral." I put down the phone and smashed my head against the desk. But she did ring back. It was the week before Christmas. She was more than happy to talk about her husband's life, but not over the phone. Which is how, two nights later, I stepped into the hallway of a semi-D with my reporter's notebook and a pen in hand. It was a cold night. The house was intensely warm, which is why my glasses instantly steamed up. I was directed into what sounded like a very noisy living room. As my glasses cleared, I found myself looking at what looked like the closing moments of an episode of This Is Your Life. Approximately 30 people who knew the man, children, brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, neighbors, and even old school friends he hadn't seen in years, were crammed into the room. There was drink taken, and there was an atmosphere of skittishness about the house. "Are you the gobshite who rang herself when she was on her way out to the funeral?" asked one man. I said, "Yes, that may very well have been me." He was drinking a Christmas cocktail that may well have been of his own creation, the main ingredients of which were Bailey's, Malibu, and whiskey. "Will you have a BMW?" he asked. I said I wouldn't have a BMW, but he handed me a BMW. I sipped it. My poor stomach didn't know whether it was summer in Jamaica or Christmas in Alaska. I listened to their stories of an ordinary man who was extraordinary to them. One anecdote drew another. Some of them sad, some of them happy, all the stuff of life. Wins and reversals, joys and disappointments, friendships forged and loved ones lost. As I was leaving, the whiskey and rum curdling the Baileys in my stomach, I could hear music coming from the kitchen. "Who's that?" I asked. "Alid Jones," she said, adding, "It's just a CD." Lest I'd think that Ella Jones was actually in her kitchen. I'd never heard the song before. Christmas songs in our house were sung by Wizard and Shaken Stevens. But this was a carol about the birth of Jesus that was so beautiful that it sent shivers through me. The words, fall on your knees, O hear the angel voices, O night divine, O night when Christ was born, stirring up the last sediments of belief from the bottom of my atheistic heart, just as it does to this day. As I said goodbye, I explained that it wouldn't be a long piece, but she didn't seem to mind, because the obituary was no longer the point. That was a lovely night, she said.
Esta noche nace un niño dentro el escar que hielo. ¿Quién pudiera, niño mío, vestirte de tercio pelo?
Time for prayer. We'll have some silence after the prayer, and it will be brought to an end by Katie singing O Holy Night. Let us pray. Lord God, maker of stars, galaxies, and all that there is, we turn our busy minds away from shopping lists and things to do, tasks to complete, and all busyness. We seek moments of quiet to find the heart of the Christmas season, which is peace. So let us breathe deeply of the peace of this quiet, sacred place. Relax into its warmth. Know that we are safe here and that we can open our hearts to this message of Christmas peace. Like the wandering couple, may we find courage to face our greatest trials. Like the harried innkeeper, may we find ways to be of help to others. Like the animals in the stable, may we be silent witnesses to the unfathomable glory of life. Like the shepherds on the hill, may we know that we need never be afraid. And like the journeying wise men, may we always have the courage to follow our star. And like the angels, may we cry peace to a troubled world. To these prayers for our transformation, we add our prayers for all those who are suffering and grieving today. May they find comfort. And we add our prayers to all those caught up in war. May they feel safe. May the season of peace and goodwill nudge the world towards ideals of peace and justice. Amen. the offertory will now be taken. And this offertory and the one on Christmas Day is all going, every penny of it, to the Capuchin Centre in Church Street. And we know from the news last week that they do have a great deal of demand on their services. Our notices. Firstly, a big thank you to everybody who worked so hard to make today's service such a success. To Katie, our singer, to Thomas, her organist, to the Letare Vocal Ensemble, who lent their lovely voices to our choir, and Josh and Gavin and Shari and all the choir, because they've been here for weeks practicing for today. Thank you, they were wonderful. And a round of applause for you all. And of course to our readers who read so well for us this morning. Downstairs there's tea and coffee served, and there's a cake sale and a craft sale, and there's a raffle. And you know, this church doesn't really very often look for money. But when we do look for money, it's generally not for ourselves. So for the raffle and the cake sale, that money's going to Focus Ireland. And so good cause, buy a ticket, have a cake and pay for it, or buy a cake and bring it home. The other thing is that we support the Capuchin Centre in another way. And the best way we can help them out is that they try to provide every child that they deal with a Christmas pyjamas, new pyjamas for Christmas, a hat and gloves and a scarf, if you like. But if you can bring those items, the hat, the scarf, the pyjamas, gloves, for under the tree. They also try to give each child a voucher for €50 for Smith's Toy Store. So that has to be Smith's Toy Store. That's where they deal with. If you can't afford €50, many people can't, even a fiver can go to be amalgamated with other vouchers for lesser amounts. But say you were very generous and you were going to spend €70 or €80 on a voucher, make one for €50 and the other for €30 or €20. Don't give us a €61 because that just complicates us. So that would be great. If you bring them, put them under the Christmas tree, we can deliver them to the Capuchin Centre. And it really would be good to have them next week, because Christmas comes middle of the week after. So that's important that we get them to them. There will be a service on the church on Christmas Day. And we just say to people, do invite your family and friends, and especially children, to this service, because that's what Christmas is about. It's about the children. On Sunday, the 29th of December, is our favourite reading service. If anyone would like to share a reading with us, if they let me know, I can tell Will, who's looking after that service. Or if you wanted to play a piece of music, that would be great as well. Denise has asked, is there anyone who would like to take a service? Because we're between ministers now, members of the congregation are taking services. Now, you mightn't be able to take the entire service. You might have an address in you. You do want to do the other part. We can arrange that. But see Denise, just to keep the volunteers that are doing it, we don't want to call on them as too often. And everybody has at least one service, one little piece of wisdom that they'd like to share with us. The other thing is, I just looked at my diary and I realised Jane Meredith's birthday is on the 19th, which is Thursday, I think. So Jane generally looks in at us, so happy birthday, Jane, if you're looking in. And the next announcement I have is a bit like code, but I have to do this to keep our legalities correctly. It's about the Cork Church. The Synod of Munster intends to hold a meeting of the members of the Cork Church, and the purpose of that meeting is to appoint new trustees for the Cork Church. And so, as I said, that's a formal notice that we're going to have that meeting. It just needs to be done for those reasons. We have our final carol now. Our blessing. Tonight everyone is displaced and homeless. Tonight everyone searches for Bethlehem. At the time when the darkness comes so close, we listen in the stillness for the songs of the angels. Like shepherds, we aren't too sure what is happening. We don't know why we are so expectant. We don't know why we long so deeply for miracles. Today we pray that we may know the one we are seeking. We may kneel in front of the kings, before which is greater than any kingdom on earth. May we seek the Holy Family and realize that we are all part of that family. And may we hear the music that reminds us of where our truest home lies.